Hey everybody, it's Eugene here and welcome to Forensics Talks. This is episode 99. It's the Wayne Gretzky edition. So if you're not from Canada, or you haven't listened to hockey or you're not a hockey fan, you might know what I'm talking about. But yeah, we're getting close to the 100th episode here. And today my guest is Nicole Nowrowski. We're going to be talking about forensic biology and DNA. And that's a subject I'm not the best at, but I'm going to do my best to, you know, ask some hard questions and see what we can get in terms of information and kinds of things she's working on. Other than that, I know it's been a busy time. I haven't done a session for a few weeks now, and it's just because I don't know about everyone else, but it's just been a pedal to the metal for a lot of people recently. So it's been really, really busy, and it's probably going to be like this, a little bit scattered on the Forensics Talks thing coming up. So yeah, we're just going to do our best to get as many of these squeezed in as possible. And since the next episode is the 100th episode, if any of you have any ideas about what to do or what to cover, I'm open, because I've been thinking about this one, and I don't know if you celebrate 100 episodes or not, or what it is you do, but maybe it's just a regular episode. But yeah, I just want to thank everybody. I know that there's some regulars that I've been watching from a long time ago now. And yeah, just grateful I can do these and meet some great people and learn a lot about forensics in general. Okay, well, my guest today is Dr. Nicole Nowrowski. She's from the University of Toronto, Mississauga, and she specializes in forensic biology and looking at things like massively parallel sequencing alongside innovative approaches for forensic human identity testing. And what we're going to be talking about today are things like genetic markers for enhanced DNA, mixture deconvolution, and a lot of her research looking at things like forensic genetic data analysis. She's doing work with microbial forensics, even work with skulls and things like that with, you know, human bones. And so there's a lot there to chew on, and I'm going to do my best, but let me bring her on in here. Let's see. There she is. Hey, Nicole, how are you?
Hi, Eugene.
All right. Well, thanks for being here. I appreciate you taking the time. I know you're a busy person and that you got a lot going on in the lab with students and everything else. So yeah, I appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Let me start with you and your background and such, and kind of where you got started. And I always ask the kid question, which is when Nicole was, you know, playing in the playgrounds and she was a lot younger than university, were you always into science? Like, were you a science kid? Were you a nerdy kid? Were you like one of the cool kids? You know, who was Nicole when she was young?
I was not the cool kid. My sister, however, you know, best dressed, Miss Popular, captain of all the teams. But I would say that I was pretty nerdy, not so nerdy that it was awkward. I don't want to call myself an awkward kid, but I definitely found that academics were always a very strong suit of mine, and I really strived super hard to do well in all of my courses. But when I was younger, I actually really wanted to be an accountant. I wanted to be an accountant up until 11th grade, and I wrote a paper in my 11th grade biology class about DNA fingerprinting and Alec Jeffries, and I was like, this science, like, you know, solved a really terrible series of crimes, and that was just so compelling that it totally set me off on a whole different path, which in 11th grade you were already kind of on that path for your credits, and so there was some pivoting that had to happen, but it was really wonderful.
Wow, that's interesting. And so were there any, I mean, when you switched over to the whole forensics area and everything else, was there somebody or something in particular that steered you that way? Was it a show? Was it a book? What was it?
So I really value service. I am an active volunteer. I'm a member of many volunteer organizations, and I really commit a lot of my time to outreach and service to the community. And quite frankly, forensic science is that perfect balance of being able to use my intellectual abilities and my critical thinking skills and my, you know, my bench skills, my technical bench skills, in order to contribute to the greater good of society, of my local community, of whomever it may be. In my role right now, I teach, so I have that impact directly with the students. But I always love having the opportunity to teach somebody who doesn't know that much about forensic science or forensic genetics a little bit more, because then it will spark a new interest in them to maybe ask more questions, look at different opportunities for themselves. So really just that service component has been the biggest driver for me in wanting to pursue this field.
Yeah. So I noticed that you do, there's a lot of online activity that you do, a lot of education and like just lectures and just sort of, you know, simple videos that explain, you know, kind of simply like what you're doing. And, you know, hopefully that will promote, you know, younger people to like get involved and get interested in what you're doing too. So do you do anything for like younger kids or sometimes or?
So I have had conversations with colleagues about developing some science communication type of workshops. I think right now, the last 5 years at the University of Toronto have been so hectic that I've really been focused on developing my undergraduate program and moving into graduate student teaching. And so now that things have lightened up a little bit for me from the curriculum development side, I think there's now a bigger opportunity to start to consider elementary school or high school. And interestingly that you asked that, in my current trends in forensic biology class this year, I actually had my students do oral presentations where they had to communicate a topic of their choice at the undergraduate level, at the high school level, at the elementary level, and then to a lay person. And I found that exercise so exciting and so interesting with everybody's different approaches that, again, I'm really starting to think about outside of the undergraduate curriculum. So I'm stealing some ideas from that class for sure, but
it'd be good. Yeah, nice. So tell me about the transition for you between university and then postgraduate studies. I'm assuming that it was forensic biology, mostly what you were focused on, like in university, and then did you know right off the bat, like, hey, I'm going to be furthering my studies. I've got to go for a master's, a PhD, or what was that transition like?
So if we're being completely honest, it was a little bit of a wild ride. I completed my undergraduate degree at the University of Toronto, Mississauga. I did a double major in forensic science and biology, and I was a B student. I was really involved. I did a lot of extracurriculars, and I was, you know, a residence don for many years. But I just wasn't at the top of my class here at UTM, where I'm now an instructor. But I left UTM and I was like, I'm very passionate about this field. Let's just see where the journey takes me. And I ended up moving out west to Alberta with some friends. And somehow I found my way working at an RCMP detachment. And the job there was not science-based. It was administrative. But watching all of the officers get dispatched to calls, and they knew that I was very passionate about forensics, so they would take me to scenes when it was suitable. And at that point, I was just like, I can't stay here. I really love working with the police, but I have to go back and do more. This is not my journey. So I applied to the master's program at the University at Albany SUNY. And I moved to Albany, New York, and did the master's in forensic molecular biology program. I fast-tracked that. And through that master's degree, I had the opportunity to intern in Minnesota. So I went to the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension and, again, made a ton of connections, really started building my passion for the field. That segued into a position with the New York City Office of Chief Medical Examiner once I graduated from my master's degree. And I was simultaneously admitted to the PhD program, but I tabled the PhD so that I could get that real life work experience. But in that real life work experience and working overtime almost every weekend, I was still wanting to do more, push the envelope. Casework obviously is very rigorous, but it's very by the book. You follow the protocol, no deviations. And I still had a lot of drive in me to ask other questions and test other philosophies and expand on the chemistries that I was learning. So at that point, I thought it was the perfect shift. I went to the University of North Texas Health Science Center under Dr. Bruce Bedoli and just had an amazing 5 years in my doctoral degree, published a lot, learned a ton, and really just, I guess, fast-tracked my career at a really prolific rate, just given all of the opportunities that Dr. Bedoli was able to provide for me. And then right after my doctoral degree, I landed my tenure track assistant professor position at the University of Toronto, and I've gone full circle. Just was recommended for tenure. So it's been just an incredible journey. Like I said, a wild ride, a lot of moving around, but very, very grateful for every one of those incredibly impactful opportunities.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And you raise up some really great points too, like about the fact that, you know, if you're working and you're practicing in certain fields, like whether it's with the police or a lab or whatever, you don't always get time to do the research and the experimentation. In fact, it's usually a side thing because, you know, it's casework. And, you know, I know a lot of labs now are just under a lot of pressure right now to get stuff out the door. So they don't have that time to play. And so working on your PhD, you know, it's that playground of, you know, hey, testing and doing all this stuff. And I have to say, like, I mean, looking at a lot of the stuff that you're doing, you put out a lot of work, which is great. Like, you're really active and you can tell you're really passionate about the work you're doing. So I think that's really great. Sorry, what year did you graduate university?
So I finished at UTM in 2009. I finished my master's in 2011. Then I went to work. I started the doctoral program in 2013 through 2018. And I've been at UTM ever since 2018.
Okay. So let me ask you, I mean, since we're talking about, you know, university and schools and stuff like that, you know, for the students that are going to be watching this at some point, what kinds of things do you think are important for students today if they want to pursue a career in forensic biology to have under their belts? What kinds of things are going to make the difference for them, you know, versus everybody else that's out there?
So I really think making the most of that undergraduate experience in terms of labs, volunteering in the PI's lab, a research lab like my own. I usually take anywhere from 6 to 12 volunteers a year just because I have so much interest. But it really does provide that additional practical opportunity for a lot of individuals who may not get it otherwise. I also think just really trying to take advantage of the volunteer opportunities. So working with organizations that allow you to gain additional perspective. We have major problems like human trafficking, but there's a lot of DNA involved in these human trafficking programs, right? So just as an example of one area that could be pursued, but tons of volunteer opportunities to learn more about a compelling field like that that's very problematic on a global scale, and just making connections with investigators and other crisis management. I really think that the more connections you make, you never know when you might need a friend. And having a big network will never do you wrong. And being kind also is just the best way to move in that direction. So when students come to me and they want a placement and they're kind and they're excited, the door is open. And I will find something for them to do and try and meet them where their technical skills are or where their research skills are, just to give them that opportunity. Because the world is a very competitive place. And if you're not being proactive and you're not taking a little bit of risk, you know, asking, is there room for me? Or can I, you know, venture to this state or this province for a summer internship? If you're not taking those leaps, you might be passed by for bigger and better opportunities just because you're not bringing that competitive element to the position.
Yeah. Let me ask you, I mean, we're talking research too now. So let me ask you about some of the work that you've been doing over the past years. And it's funny because when I always look sometimes at sort of your compendium of research, and you can see that there's a transition. There's just sort of a path, and you've kind of moved into a few different areas. But let me ask you, I mean, how would you describe the direction that your early research has taken onto what you're doing today?
So what's really interesting is that I'm still working on a couple of things that I've been working on now for almost a decade, being the DNA mixtures. My doctoral degree focused heavily on DNA mixture deconvolution, and very gratefully, I was awarded a National Institute of Justice grant with co-principal investigator Mike Coble out of UNT to pursue that work even further for 2024, 2025. So not letting that ship sail off yet. I'm going to keep working in that area. But I would say some of the other things that I've transitioned away from are the pharmacogenetic studies that I did years ago. But we still talk about that in my lectures. And we still have conversations about what that looks like in terms of practice. Transfer and persistence is a really big area of interest. It was one of my first publications back in 2011 when I interned in Minnesota. And now as a PI, I have a handful of students who are working on transfer and persistence projects. One's actually in collaboration with the Center of Forensic Sciences. And then another one was awarded the Forensic Sciences Foundation Lucas Grant. And so there's a lot of interest there, obviously, from the community to investigate transfer and persistence, but it's looking different and definitely more sensitive and math-based these days than it did back in 2011. And then I just have a ton of smaller projects going on. So we have students interested in microbial forensics. We have students that are looking at population data for Canada's populations. We don't have a lot of forensic allele frequency data that's updated in the last several years. And so I have a team of researchers who are pursuing that. And then also excitedly, I was awarded a second National Institute of Justice grant this year, again, with collaboration with UNT and also Sam Houston State University, and that's in forensic genetic genealogy. So moving into a new area, which is really exciting and obviously very heavily promoted in the media right now with all of these incredible DNA solves. So trying to stay current, always trying to push that envelope and learn more and do more and be able to contribute to the field in a very impactful way.
Yeah. I want to ask you about some of the core stuff you're doing, but let me ask you about a few others that I'd seen, and maybe I'll start with the furthest one I was looking at. Direct PCR amplification of DNA from human blood stains, saliva, and touch samples collected with the microfluidic swabs. What was that one about?
So the microflock.
Microflock.
No problem. I mean, it's a tricky one. The microflock swab is a very cool nylon swab that's ideal for, like you said, touch samples, but also for sampling from a larger substrate if you want to get a quick answer. It's like a speck. If you were to pull the swab out, and I should have brought one as a demo, but it's just like a speck of nylon fibers that when it makes contact with the biological material, it does undergo some cell lysis, meaning that the cells open up and the DNA is more freely accessible. And then it goes directly into an amplification reaction. So instead of doing a DNA extraction, which would separate the DNA from all of the other debris and materials, you're going straight into the amplification reaction to see if you can get a DNA profile. And interestingly, I'm still using the microflock in other research and development projects currently. So we've evolved from blood, semen, saliva, the common substrates, to now I'm looking at vasectomized versus non-vasectomized male DNA recovery using these touch samples to see if we can still get, you know, sufficient DNA from a vasectomized individual in the absence of sperm. And then also on gun cartridge casings.
Oh, okay. Oh, wow. Okay. That's pretty cool.
So lots of different things that we're exploring with regard to the touch and the direct amp. It does really just skip a step for those people who are not so familiar with the DNA workflow.
What about there was another one you had here that says forensic genetic approaches for the identification of human skeletal remains. That one in particular, what did you do there?
So that was actually a book. I contributed a couple of chapters to that book, focusing in on single nucleotide polymorphisms, also known as SNPs. SNPs are really popular right now because of genetic genealogy. But my discussion was talking about how SNPs can be utilized for a variety of forensic applications. Those include traditional human identity. Those also include ancestry. So being able to take a DNA sample and determine somebody's ancestral background, looking at phenotype. So your hair color, eye color, skin pigmentation, inferring a potential picture of a person with modest confidence. We don't want to overstipulate exactly what you look like or what I look like from that data, but it does give inference as to what somebody may look like. And then lineage markers and those kinship markers that I've already talked about. And so my focus to contribute to that piece of work was to just really explain how SNPs can be used. And I also wrote another chapter on the technologies. So massively parallel sequencing, that's a newer technology that forensic labs are starting to adopt. I believe Kern County out of California was the first lab to have it introduced into court for an active case. And that was really, really wonderful work that was done out of that lab, where massively parallel sequencing really just gives you a lot more bang for your buck in terms of a DNA sample. So instead of processing your sample with our current methods, so amplification and then generating a DNA profile with capillary electrophoresis, we get a lot of information about the quantity and quality of a DNA sample. And so that's a really cool technology that's been around and I have a lot of experience with now for about a decade, but finally is gaining some true traction in the forensic arena.
Okay. Do we call the name of the book offhand? Shannon is asking here about the one that you co-admitted a chapter to.
That's the name, what you said.
Oh, that was the name of the book?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's here. Let me just bring it up here. So it was, well, there was Forensic Genetic Approaches for the Identification of Human Skeletal Remains, Challenges, Best Practices, and Emerging Technology. So that's what it's called, Shannon. Okay. So Nicole, in the field of like forensic biology and like DNA and all that, how would you classify the sub-disciplines or some of the major areas where that people focus on? And I think you've mentioned some of them or whatever, but maybe just so I can get a bigger picture of what they all are. So like phenotyping you talked about and genealogy, but like what are all the disciplines and are there any new ones? Are there any emerging ones as well?
So that's a really interesting question. And I think it's important to first think about the fact that traditional forensic casework is going to follow a very standard and consistent workflow where the evidence comes in from the investigators. You extract the DNA, you determine how much DNA is there, you amplify our core CODIS markers, those markers that everybody around the world is in some form or fashion trying to capture. And then we generate that DNA profile that's ideal for court. And separate from that, we do have those different areas. So we have ancestry and phenotype exploration, but those are typically used as investigative leads, much like forensic genetic genealogy. So forensic genetic genealogy, to my knowledge, current time and day right now, has only been validated in two public forensic labs, both in the United States, one of them being UNT, who I'm fortunate enough to collaborate with so frequently. But forensic genetic genealogy from an investigator standpoint is heavily used and it's often outsourced to private labs to generate that DNA profile that then gets built into those family trees. And then the investigation continues from the police agency using the leads that they've developed for a person of interest from that information. And then we also have things like rapid DNA typing. So rapid DNA typing has different roles in different jurisdictions. I know in Canada, it could always have a really big humanitarian approach if we had a mass disaster of sorts, because it's really good for single source samples or samples that come from one person. We can do quick identifications. But I think Peel Regional Police is also investigating the use of rapid DNA for some of their crime scene samples or maybe those high volume samples. So rapid DNA really is this single machine that sample in, DNA profile out in about 90 or so minutes. It does allow for an expedited turnaround time, I guess, on those DNA profiles. And massively parallel sequencing, which is definitely my bread and butter, is something that you can utilize for a variety of applications. So like I said, like ancestry, SNP, phenotype, we can do some genealogy work on that. We can do traditional identity marker capture. It can do whole genome sequencing. All of these different things can be done. And that's a technology that still is being considered by a lot of labs, still is never going to enter a lot of labs just based on cost, but has the potential to really contribute in a big way. Outside of that, I feel like we're going to see other branches develop. So our techniques in terms of looking at methylation are drastically increasing, and methylation is being used for age prediction, but it's also being used for body fluid identification and things of that nature. I'm very less familiar with DNA methylation. I haven't done a lot of work there, but proteomics, all kinds of things. I would expect that over the next 5 to 10 years, we start seeing bigger branches of differentiation within forensic genetics. And that will be a really cool thing to see. And I think our DNA conferences will evolve to respond to that. Much like the Academy meeting has all of the disciplines, I could see our forensic genetics meetings having multiple like sub-disciplines that allow people to cluster within the pools that they're doing the work in. We're not there yet. Everything is still always on the table at our meetings, but it is a really, really exciting time in forensic genetics because we have so many different avenues that are transitioning into the limelight.
Yeah. Let me ask you about, so you had me jumping through a few different things here, but one of them was having to do with statistics and a lot of the math that's behind, you know, a lot of what you can say about an identification or mixed samples and stuff like that. So who are some of the leaders or who are some of the people who come up with these things and how do they get adopted? Like, how does somebody say, you know, look, this method is better than this method, or are there different methods used under different scenarios?
So that's a really good question. I think it comes down to interest or public need. So you're always going to have all of those grant submissions to the National Institute of Justice or whatever funding agency on an annual basis to develop new approaches to all kinds of different things. So whether it's working with very fragile samples like skeletal remains or hair and low template DNA types of samples, whether a group wants to explore, like I said, methylation or proteomics or go in these radically new directions, whether they're focusing on mitochondrial DNA, whatever it may be. And I think what happens is it's a very small community. So we all go to the same meetings. We all see what everybody is doing. And then it's a need-based response. So if the FBI or the National Institute of Standards and Technology starts taking a look at your work, that's when you know that, oh, this might be of big interest to the national community or the international community. The same can be said in Canada. So forensic genetic genealogy or investigative genetic genealogy is definitely a hot topic. And we're having these conversations at the government level or between labs and investigators and other, you know, political officials or privacy commissioner, whomever it may be. We're having these conversations because it's become a point of public interest, but also a need to serve society in that way. And so that's why I think you see things like genetic genealogy really taking off, because there's that immediate public benefit. But things like phenotyping have kind of taken a back burner. It had a quick moment there in the sun, and then now it's still an investigative tool that we can utilize, but it's not so much on the forefront or not the focus as frequently at meetings. And I think it's always just really in response to what the needs are. So there is always that flux. I think projects ebb and flow, like my DNA mixtures. For a minute there, I was like, I guess we're done here, but now we're back at it. So I'm going to take the grants and I'm going to do my best work and hope for the best that the community receives my contributions to be valuable.
Okay. You've been at this now for, you know, well over a decade and doing a lot of different work and stuff like that. So, and correct me if I'm wrong. So the general, if you, at a high level, you're talking about, like, you collect a sample, there's the extraction, right? Like, you have to extract DNA, then there's quantitation, and then there is the amplification. Like, those three steps. If you were to look at each one of those steps, it's a big question, but how has each one of those processes changed over the years? Have there been big improvements in the way that you can now extract the DNA, the quantitation? Has that improved a lot? You know, so what can you tell me about those three areas?
So I'm going to say that everything has improved. And I see a question in the chat about sensitivity, and sensitivity actually, I think, is the big driver to the improvements of what we're seeing. So if you go back to 1985, when DNA fingerprinting first came online, we needed a ton of a biological material. So we're talking about like a full quarter size or more stain in terms of being able to generate enough information. And it took a really long time. And then it wasn't as informative. So it would narrow it down to one in X number of people, but it would still leave a lot of people who could be considered in terms of the DNA profile. Now, as we've fast forwarded, we're now targeting much smaller markers, and we're now targeting more markers. So we've seen the evolution with CODIS, so the FBI's National DNA Database. We've moved from a few markers to then 13 markers was the gold standard for a really long time, and now we're up to 20. That increase in the number of markers, and that comes in at the amplification step, is very impactful and greatly increases the power of discrimination when making an identity determination as to who may or may not have contributed to a DNA sample. But taking a step back and thinking about DNA extraction, our extraction techniques are incredibly specific now. So we have very, very tailored techniques for if you were to do a cartridge casing, or if you were to process bone, or if you're looking at rootless hair shafts, all of these things that, you know, 20, 30 years ago would be impossibilities for acquiring DNA from, that we can now, if not get a full profile, we can get some DNA information from those types of substrates. And that leads into quantification. So determining how much DNA is there. Some of the assays go right down to less than a cell of DNA, incredibly, incredibly sensitive. And so to that point in the chat of that increased sensitivity, context is always incredibly important. And we've seen that movement about transfer and persistence of DNA in the courtroom. So we don't question necessarily that there is DNA there, but how did it get there? Who put it there? What are the various scenarios for the DNA to have gotten there? And that's a far more complicated question because it introduces so many variables. And then it also allows for people to argue various scenarios as to why their DNA was there, but why they still didn't do it. And I don't have all of the answers for that. I will say that I am working in that area, and we have done several different types of experiments, but transfer and persistence and activity level propositions about DNA deposition is still an ever evolving and a very complicated area. And I don't think we'll ever go back. I think that we're only going to become more and more sensitive. I think the expansion of how much DNA information can be collected from a single sample will continue to grow. And that's also a tricky thing. So where the ethics around how much information we should have on a particular sample, and when we start getting into that public health information, and I know that it's been a hot topic in genetics genealogy, but I think that with proper legislation and also using just a best practices approach for forensic DNA typing, right? The forensic scientist ideally, or in my mind, is there to best represent the evidence to help society. We're not there to suggest innocence or guilt. It's not our job to have any opinion necessarily about the alleged person of interest or the suspect, but to best represent that evidence. And so as long as we're doing that in a best practices approach, I think that our increased sensitivity or our better techniques can only serve us to serve society. So
let me ask you about phenotyping for a second. You brought that up a little bit before. Where are we today on phenotyping? Is it still in its very early stages? Is there still a lot of room to grow there? What kinds of things can we get out? And I'm, you know, in my head, I'm thinking about even people that are doing like the reconstructions, you know, they're doing full reconstructions. And I see all online all the time, people doing, hey, you know, we did some phenotyping and, you know, here's what this person looked like, you know, back then or whatever. So, and I always question some of that. I think some of it is a little bit of wow factor stuff or whatever, but yeah, where are we in terms of phenotyping? How well can we perform?
So there are several different panels. And when I say panels, I just mean like a mixture of genetic targets that we're looking at. There are a variety of different panels out there for externally visible characteristics. So you can have a panel that focuses on hair color alone, on eye color, on pigmentation. Like I said, we're moving into like age prediction and things of that nature. The problem, or the biggest limitation, because there are a lot of known regions in the DNA that will infer these externally visible characteristics, but they are polygenic, meaning that multiple parts of the human genome interact in order to give rise to the phenotype or what we see expressed in an individual. And that complexity makes predictions sometimes difficult. Now, if it's blue eyes or not blue eyes, brown hair or not brown hair, those predictions can be a little bit more straightforward. But when we get into the intermediate traits, so individuals who have hazel eyes and green eyes, or their hair color is that light brown, auburn, red sometimes can be tricky to predict. Those types of characteristics become more complicated. Genetic admixture plays a huge role there. And what I mean by that is just looking back in our ancestry, we have that exchange of genetic information from different parts of the world. Those intermediate traits that are coded in our DNA are just hard to fully explain from a genetic perspective to then predict what a person will look like with a high degree of accuracy. So I think that forensic DNA phenotyping definitely can be used as an investigative lead, especially if you're trying to use it for something like a missing persons investigation. But I would never use it to narrow down a suspect pool where you're then going to only look at a specific group of individuals based on these traits, because it could be uninformative. For example, my forensic DNA phenotyping profile says that I have blonde hair. My mom was a blonde when she was young. I have always had very dark brown hair, but my genetics say that I have that blonde trait. And so I always put a picture up in my slides with a wig on, and all of the students laugh because, you know, it's just so unrealistic as to what I look like. However, it does reinforce that fact that we just have to treat the unknowns with as much attention as we treat the knowns. And so being mindful that there are limitations, but it can be incredibly useful, especially, like I said, in those missing persons instances.
Okay. Let's get into forensic genealogy. I think that's another topic that you're spending a bit of time on now these days. And yeah, even actually, I think you published a paper in, was it 20, just recently, right? 2024? Oh, no. Yeah. Identifying distant relatives using benchtop scale sequencing, right? There's that one that you just did recently. So, well, let's start with forensic genealogy. How would you describe that to somebody in terms of how it is different to, you know, just regular, you know, making an identification in the lab kind of thing?
Sure. So our traditional forensic DNA typing happens in those accredited forensic labs. The investigators submit their sample to the lab. The lab processes it through that workflow. So extraction, quant, AMP, generating that DNA profile, does the comparison, sometimes uploads to the criminal DNA database, sometimes, you know, has concordance with a person of interest. It goes to court, and then there we go. The outcome will be the outcome in the courtroom. Now, what happens when you don't have somebody to compare to, or you upload to the criminal DNA database and there's just nothing, like there are no concordant profiles? The case will eventually start to lose steam. There's no more new leads. There are no more new evidence. There's nothing really more that can be done. And so that's when investigators have started to turn to forensic genetic genealogy. And I would say that forensic genetic genealogy is a niche investigative tool. So it's being used primarily right now for either active or cold cases. And I say cold cases, but just historical cases, cases that are older than a few years, for violent crimes. So things like homicide or sexual assault or, you know, very severe crimes, and or unidentified human remains and missing persons. So there's really two big categories that we're focusing on with forensic genetic genealogy. And in the United States, the federal government has actually stipulated a bunch of conditions that labs and investigators should be following when choosing those cases and choosing the samples. But you can look that up later, and I'll just keep talking about the science. Mm-hmm. But then when investigators are like, okay, we're going to pursue forensic genetic genealogy, that's when you have to go back to that biological evidence. So A, you have to have the biological evidence still available. And sometimes in these historical cases, that may or may not be possible. And then it has to be in sufficient quality and quantity to then be typed for the purposes of searching further. And how investigators are doing this right now, oftentimes they're outsourcing to private labs who are processing that evidence and generating sufficient DNA information that's compatible for upload. Now, a traditional person, so if it was just me at home and I wanted to participate in forensic genetic genealogy, I would likely go to my direct consumer company like 23andMe or Ancestry DNA and send my saliva swab off, get the information from that private company, and then download my DNA file. Because that's what's happening from the public perspective, is that you have these direct-to-consumer sites that offer a product, people have paid for them, they send off their sample, they get the product, they get that internal private database from these companies, but then they also get a copy of their DNA data. And then they go home and they upload that into a public database like GEDmatch. GEDmatch, I think, is one of the biggest ones. MyHeritage DNA, I think, is another one. And we're seeing that these public databases have really grown in volume because people, A, are interested, and B, in light of forensic genetic genealogy, want to contribute to that forensic genetic genealogical search. What's really interesting is that when you have your own DNA data file, when you upload it into GEDmatch as just a private citizen, a private user, you have to go through a very detailed informed consent process. That informed consent process allows you to acknowledge who may be using the database, and it also allows you to opt in or opt out of investigators utilizing your DNA information for those violent crime searches. Now, when it comes to the missing persons, I believe that everybody's DNA is reviewed, but for the violent crime and a lot of those DNA solves that we're seeing on TV or in the media, that is an opt-in, opt-out situation. And so there is that informed consent piece from the individual who's personally uploading that sample. Investigators and forensic practitioners access a different form of GEDmatch, which is a paid service that has different tools. When the Golden State Killer case happened, they just used the regular public database. But since that time, GEDmatch has changed ownership and it's been upgraded and a lot of different features and tools have been added. But there is that special access for investigators. And that does allow for more of a record of continuity to be maintained for those investigative searches. And they're also only searching those samples from the private citizen standpoint who have opted in. But they search that with their crime scene DNA data file. They develop some top hits. Those hits could be a close relative to a person of interest, a distant relative to a person of interest. It's really all going to depend who's in the database at the time of the search and how good that DNA evidence is. So many different variables to think about. When they have that hit or that match, whatever you want to call it, they have to then build out that family tree and try to understand who these individuals are that are the top ranked matches. And that can be very, very cumbersome. Typically, investigators rely on genealogists to do a lot of that work to fill in the blanks of all of those people. People's family trees can be very small. They can be incredibly large. It looks very different in every single case and in every single scenario. And so there's a lot of genealogical work using public records and all of that additional information that goes into developing those trees and then exploring the person of interest. But then the investigator has to determine, does this person make sense? Were they at the wrong place at the wrong time? Or are they the appropriate age? All of those things that, even though you develop these people of interest, are they relevant to the investigation? And then the investigators take over again. So then they have to do the investigative work to make those connections. If they end up determining a person of interest is likely the perpetrator, we go right back to that traditional forensic DNA typing. A sample is collected and it's compared to the original evidence in that same DNA profile scenario. So forensic genetic genealogy is an incredible tool, but right now we're still going full circle back to our original ways to make that identity determination or that confirmation, if you want to put it that way.
And, you know, you talked about, I think I heard you say once that, you know, people have a willingness to help. And did you, if I heard correctly, you said that after the Golden State Killer case, there was like an uptick in uploads or people like giving their DNA or making it available?
So yeah. the Golden State Killer case obviously sent just the butterfly effect or like that ripple effect where there was all of this panic, a lot of ethical and moral concerns and considerations. But we also saw this huge change in the DNA databases. So a lot of people maybe didn't even know about GEDmatch because they just used 23andMe, utilized their software, were happy with their findings, maybe learned something about themselves and called it a day. But the Golden State Killer case put GEDmatch on the radar. And it also created an opt-in, opt-out scenario. So everybody was at one point kicked out of GEDmatch and had to re-opt in under the new informed consent criteria. And that was very significant because we did see an increase in the number of uploads. And I really think that comes down to people wanting to help. So innately, we are good humans and we want to help and we want to contribute to society. And there are a lot of testimonials, I think, on GEDmatch now of, oh, my sample helped catch Uncle Bob who committed a crime 30 years ago. And sorry, but don't commit crimes, Uncle Bob, type of scenario. So I think it really comes down to the fact that people want to do good. And this is a tool for people to contribute to society in that way. I know there's that slang term like armchair detectives, and I feel like this is where a lot of those people can really shine in terms of making their contribution to solving crime. And the impact of the uploads has been significant. We have seen so many cases be solved because of this. But I do want to point out something really interesting about these solves. So our criminal databases, like our criminal DNA databases, are comprised of often convicted offenders, and then we have our crime scene samples. And the public DNA databases, really, we're just at the mercy of whoever puts their sample in there. And so we're apprehending at times these one-off violent criminals. So they committed a crime 30 years ago, and then they just went back to cutting the grass on Sunday and living their lives and never doing anything else. And they never ended up in a criminal DNA database. But then forensic genetic genealogy or investigative genetic genealogy comes along, and now we got them. And that's very, very interesting, because in theory, those cases would have remained unsolved potentially forever without this investigative technique. And so I think there's just a moment of reflection to be had about that significant contribution to solving those particular cases where certain individuals just would have never been apprehended. And that's very powerful to me.
That's pretty amazing. I saw something in one of your papers, and I don't know if it was this one from 2024, but how far back can you go, you know, generation wise? And what is the limit to how far you can go back? Like, when does this start to become, is it just that things become so thin, you just can't tell anymore?
So when we're looking at the DNA data, there are different categories of how you can look at the DNA data. So one of the main approaches right now, there's a kit called Kintelligence, and it's manufactured by QIAGEN. QIAGEN is the parent company of Verigen. Verigen owns GEDmatch. It's kind of like a little circle. But the Kintelligence panel looks at 10,000 SNPs, or 10,000 of those single sites in the DNA. And that can be incredibly useful, but we start to see some drop off at that fourth degree relative. And I don't want to explain how far out that is. You'd really have to look at a family tree map to understand like the cousins and the aunts and uncles and all of the different potential relationships that comprise those, you know, second degree, third degree, fourth degree relatives. So we do start to see some limitations when we're only looking in the thousands of SNPs. But then when you think about some of these other technologies, and I know whole genome sequencing sounds really scary, but it doesn't have to be, or these large SNP arrays that are looking at 600 or 7,000 SNPs, much the same way these direct-to-consumer companies look at, like they're gathering all of that information, and that's what you're getting in your DNA data file. So when you start to look in those hundreds of thousands of SNPs, we can actually move out fifth degree, sixth degree, seventh degree relatives. And again, that's really the confidence that we're going to have in our ability to make predictions within a family tree is going to depend on the quality of the DNA being compared. So if you have a really, really poor forensic DNA sample that just doesn't have a lot of that SNP information, you had a lot of failures in trying to generate those hundreds of thousands of SNP targets, then we're going to run into some problems. Now, one topic that's mentioned in the literature and that we're hearing more and more at conferences is this term imputation, where we start to try and model or fill in the blanks with DNA data so that we can make predictions. And it definitely has value. It just has to be used in the right way. So if we use it in the right way and we're being very conservative or stringent with our imputation, it can still allow us to develop some very significant investigative leads. Sometimes it's overused and then we go down the wrong path and then we realize we don't have enough information to work with. And that's also something that we have to be that we have to accept and be cognizant of, that something like forensic genetic genealogy is an incredible tool. And my 2024 paper talks about how we can really start to utilize the chemistries we have in our forensic labs to make this happen so that it's occurring in our local environment. But with that, not every sample is going to work, and we're not going to be able to solve every case with this technology. Some cases don't even have forensic evidence or biological evidence associated with them. So there's not a lot we can do in those instances. And sometimes the DNA is just in too poor of condition to make an accurate prediction. And the last thing that we want is to be in a circumstance where there's, you know, a wrongful conviction or something of that nature, right? We want to steer clear of anything that's going to take us into a gray area of confidence. And so, yeah, it's really wonderful, but I do think we just have to be mindful of where those limitations are in terms of the DNA information and making those connections. But if you're talking about a seventh degree relative, that's a lot of work for the genealogist. That's a huge family tree. It's probably going back, you know, great grandparent, great, great grandparent, over, down. How many siblings did they have in the 1900s, in the 1950s, et cetera? So very, very big tree.
Wow. So yeah, so this imputation is really fascinating. I didn't know about that. So how do you decide how to fill in the blanks? So now I'm like, wait a second, filling in the blanks. Like, is it because you have relatives, or you know you have relatives, or you know the tree, and you can kind of like, how does that work?
It's mathematical modeling and educated guessing based on DNA information. So it's not based on. It's not necessarily based on that person's relatives. It's based on if this person is of, say, European ancestry, and the genotypes for Europeans at this particular site are these, then we can model with X number of confidence that this missing nucleotide or this missing DNA base is this. And so that's a very simplistic version of it, but ultimately it's educated decision-making. And it really does come down to the quality and the amount of DNA data available. You would not want to set that bar really low and just be trying to fill in the blanks everywhere, because it's going to be wrong, and you're going to end up with the wrong person of interest. And that will obviously just waste everybody's time. So,
yeah. Okay. So talk to me about the most recent paper and what you're doing today in the area of forensic genealogy. So the identifying distant relatives using benchtop scale sequencing. Why is that important?
Right. So for all of those individuals who are doing massively parallel sequencing or that next generation sequencing for their traditional markers, so I talked about, you know, Kern County in California bringing it online for a regular human identity. If you have one of those instruments in the lab, my team, so working with Dr. August Warner out of UNT and Dr. Cherie Hughes out of Sam Houston, we were awarded that big NIJ grant. The NIJ grant is going to explore bringing a genetic genealogy within the forensic arena into your public forensic lab using those benchtop sequencing instruments. And what that means is doing whole genome sequencing on our benchtop sequencing instrument, which really hasn't been done in forensic science or forensic genetics thus far for a variety of reasons. Whole genome sequencing, like I said, can get really complicated, especially from those ethical and public health perspectives. But if we can generate our samples in-house using this approach and generate a DNA data file that's suitable for upload into GEDmatch, then the forensic lab can do it all. They can get the sample from the investigator, run it through our traditional ways. If those traditional ways do not give you any kind of answer, then you can do genetic genealogy right on the instrument that you already have. And so that paper is kind of the teaser to the bigger grant and the additional work that we're going to do. But it does already demonstrate that a benchtop sequencer like the MiSeq or the S5, something like that, for those who know what those instruments are, and I apologize to those who don't, but that benchtop sequencer can do so much more than you think it can. And it really will bring genetic genealogy like back down to scale so that a lab doesn't have to think about buying a high throughput instrument that's like $1 million and then super, super expensive consumables and chemicals that are needed to run that $1 million instrument. You already have the tool. And so it's just making use of what you already have, because for all of us in the forensic lab, we know that money is often the limitation, and obviously personnel and other resources. But if we're not spending extra money and we're not constantly reinventing the wheel and forcing labs to purchase a new instrument, we're really trying to push the envelope with the chemistry so that you can use the technology that you already have and make this accessible to a larger volume of labs, just a greater contribution to the community, because I don't think anybody else has tried it yet. And I was the one who generated the data for that paper. And I have to tell you, when I came in the next day to see if the run had passed or failed, I was nervous, and it passed, and it is informative, and we are full steam ahead. So exciting things to come for sure. Yeah, it's really great. It's such a promising future in all aspects of forensic genetics, but I'm very obviously passionate about DNA mixtures and genealogy.
Yeah, for sure. There's a question here from Shannon. I'm going to bring it up. How long do you think the R&D will take to get to the point where a local lab could process highly degraded samples using benchtop sequencing?
So the technology and the chemistry and the validations are already there. Not necessarily from a genetic genealogy standpoint to answer that question, but from a traditional human identity standpoint. There are several publications, and I'd be happy to forward them to Eugene to disseminate how he needs to. But something like the Forenseq panel or the Mainstay panel, or even some of those whole genome mitochondrial DNA panels, could process highly degraded samples with high efficiency and generate very good DNA profiles, even when the samples are in poor quality, poor quantity. We've had samples that didn't quantify, meaning that there was no detectable DNA when we checked, but then we were able to get almost a full DNA profile using the benchtop sequencing. So the benchtop sequencing really does allow us to make the most out of our DNA sample, and it does have quite good sensitivity even when we don't know how much DNA we're even working with.
Okay. Let's squeeze in the mixed profiles. You're talking about it's the other area that you're interested in. So what are you working on there?
So we currently rely on those core CODIS markers that are dictated by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. So everything goes through, you know, that policy at the federal level. It trickles down, eventually makes itself into the smaller labs and then out into the international community. Now, what I'm doing and what is an extension of my doctoral work is looking at different areas in the human genome, areas in the human genome where there's enough variability between individuals that you can better tell them apart when their DNA is mixed. So what happens sometimes in a DNA mixture, especially if you have relatives in a DNA mixture, is you can't always tell who is who and who contributed what DNA to that DNA mixture. But if we pick additional regions in the DNA that are more variable, so they have just like a higher frequency of diversity, then we can utilize those to support who contributed how much of their DNA to a DNA mixture. And so that's really the focus of the project, is to look at additional regions in the human genome that can better tell people apart when you mix their DNA together. And why that's important is because coupled with something like benchtop sequencing that gives us a lot of quantitative information, it can be really hard when you have multiple contributors. So there was a homicide, maybe two people touched the weapon, and then you have other DNA that was collected that may or may not be relevant. Well, the ratios of those component contributors becomes really, really important. And this technology, coupled with looking at those additional regions in the DNA, can be so much more informative that we're not having to only rely on our statistics. Because complex DNA mixtures right now in the forensic lab are treated with probabilistic genotyping. There are different software tools out there. And all that means is we use this very sophisticated software that models all possible combinations of the mixtures and gives us a confidence as to which one makes the most sense, and then gives us a stat or a likelihood ratio that we can report out on why, how much more probable this scenario is over another. But if we can do better at the biological level, like if we can gain more information right from the DNA, then we're less reliant on those complex statistics and that mathematical modeling. We are just trying to make it easier right at the beginning so that it doesn't have to get more complicated. Because when you're trying to explain a likelihood ratio to the jury or anybody in the courtroom, people get confused, people misstate the propositions of the likelihood ratio. Things get really, really messy very, very quickly. And so all about just making things simpler, which is very complicated in the background, but the goal is to make it simpler for the end user.
That's so if I understand correctly, it's really about, you know, looking outside of what's traditionally being looked at these other areas or markers that have this higher variability, because, you know, they can tell you a lot more about that particular individual, or maybe, you know, maybe you can identify a person based on those other areas. So people are not looking there because of why? It's just, this is the way we do it, the kind of thing?
Well, we have a well-oiled machine. If it's not broken, don't fix it. And our stats are good. Our stats are good. But what's happened, and I think this goes back again to that one, Mike's question about that increased sensitivity, is that we're now being able to pick up low-level DNA profiles that had nothing to do with the crime at hand. And we rely upon that mathematical modeling to make sense of those data. And so, again, just having more insight into whose DNA is there and why it might be there is just going to, like, knowledge is power. And so this is just meant to provide additional information, provide additional education about the DNA sample. And, you know, a couple of markers, maybe they'll make it in 5-10 years, you'll see them added. Maybe they won't, but we'll have it as an investigative tool, much the way we have phenotyping and ancestry and genealogy. So there's always that application where it might be a one-off use for, you know, a case study. I don't know. It's hard to say. I mean, 5 years ago, I never thought we'd be here with genealogy, and look at us now. So yeah. I'm really open to wherever the journey takes me and wherever the journey takes the field, and just constantly adapting my approach and my mentality to be able to contribute as best as I can.
You brought up a really good point, actually, and it's something that's come up. I remember talking about this years ago, and I'm not sure if it's changed at all, but it had to do with the complexity of communication of DNA results to, like, a judge or a jury or someone that's maybe not technical. And so are there ways, or has anyone thought about any ways? I mean, you see the graphs and, you know, with the spikes and stuff like that or whatever. And I'm just wondering if there's a way of communicating that differently, or Is it just a comparison? Like, typically you line up the graphs and you show it, but have you seen any other ways, or are there any techniques or any ways you communicate this to a jury that makes it easy for them to understand?
I think sometimes just putting it in a table, right? And it's a matching game. It's all about matching. Does the person of interest's DNA profile match at every single number to the crime scene profile, or does the missing person's DNA profile match at every single place to the unidentified human remains? What we look for is that complete and utter concordance in order to not exclude the person with relation to whatever our question sample is. So unidentified human remains, crime scene, paternity, parentage, kinship, whatever it may be. And it's really about, you know, the known person being compared to the question sample, and if there is complete and utter concordance. And I think keeping it simple, like matching up the numbers, is a much more straightforward way than hearing you talk about an electropherogram with those, you know, the little mountains or the peaks, because that is really cumbersome and convoluted, and it's not very straightforward, and you don't understand why things are one height and other things are another height, and why they're different colors. And, you know, that's all the chemistry being shown in the, like, that background chemistry. And when I was talking to you, you know, not during this podcast, but just about my passion about forensic science education, I think that there's, like, a really big opportunity for the community to come together and continue to evolve our ways of communicating science to, you know, a younger audience, a lay audience. One thing that is on YouTube, I believe my student who was a master's student in the biomedical communications program, she made a video on DNA mixture deconvolution. And we talked about how to explain what a short tandem repeat or an STR is. And I think about it, you know, you have your DNA. The human genome is a long highway, and those STRs are the rest stops along the way. So they're not, you don't have to stop at them. They're not critically important for anything. They don't code for a gene. They don't lead to functionality. But if you do stop, you're going to notice that one person and the other person, those are different, right? The left side of the road and the right side of the road, they have different rest stops, so different information. And as you travel along the road, you encounter these different rest stops and you see that the differences between these sites. And so thinking about ways to explain science like that is always something that is in the back of my mind, because I always want to make what I do relatable. I'll never forget, you know, I had a friend who was like, you know, you were talking about, I don't even know what. And then this physiologist totally understood what they were talking about because it had to do with cancer or something that people were far more familiar with. And I was really humbled by that. And so I always practice, like, my parents aren't scientists, and I always try and make sure that they fully understand what I'm talking about. They could not be more proud. But I think one of the coolest moments of my whole life came just last weekend. I was in Texas with friends, and I have this friend who, to be honest, I never thought he was listening when I talked to him about my work. And we were out somewhere, and I had just, you know, been recommended for tenure. And so we were celebrating, and to hear him talk about my work and to explain DNA mixture deconvolution and what I am passionate about and what I focus on was, it truly just, it just left such an imprint on my heart. I was like, oh my gosh, he does listen. Oh my gosh, he knows exactly what I'm talking about. And oh my gosh, I must have explained it well enough to him for him to remember and then be able to explain it to other people. So I think that, like, we're going to end here. Like, that's the moment to end on, but
yeah. Yeah. Well, good job, Nicole's friend, for listening. That's good. Right. Yeah, yeah. We need more friends like that. Last major question, and that is just, you've got research going on. You've got grants. Congratulations on those too. And, you know, just other things coming up. So what is next? What is next for you? What's the next major milestones for you?
Well, to be honest, right now it's an open road. So I am going on sabbatical this upcoming summer for the next year. And I'm really going to dedicate most of that time to those two big grants. And then after that, I mean, you know, life is a wild ride. So I'm just hanging on and I'm just going with the flow. I really find that you never know what's going to happen. Obviously, the pandemic for a lot of people changed our perspective, and I definitely think it did for me. I'm definitely trying to live more in the moment, not plan everything, although, you know, schedule through 2024 is already full, but really just seeing where the community is evolving and adapting accordingly. Because as somebody who focuses on progressive research, I don't want to get too caught in my ways and my interests that I'm not responding to what the community actually needs, because then at the end of these grants, I won't get more if I'm not moving in that direction. And so I think my goal is to just keep expanding that network, hopefully start some new collaborations, go in some new areas of interest as they relate to either my areas or other people's. Like, I love collaborating and just trying new things. And so kind of just going where the forensic wind takes me, I guess. We'll see. I don't know. Don't want to lock anything down.
Excellent. Well, look, I'm going to bring up your sites here. So you've got, like, NicoleNabrowski.com, and there's also the University of Toronto where people can find you. So in case somebody wants to reach out to you, you've got all your research listed here, and there's a bunch of other, like, links and such to just videos and things like that. And also on YouTube, like, there's a ton of stuff that you've got on YouTube, which is a great resource for everyone here as well. So Nicole, thank you very, very much. Great, great discussion, great information. And I really, really appreciate it.
Yes. Thank you so much for having me. And for anyone listening or who listens in the future, that website information won't go away. So please reach out if you have any other questions.
Excellent. Do me a favor, hang back when you get a chance, and I'm looking forward to talking to you soon. Thank you. All right. So that does it for this episode, folks. Thank you so much. Great information there. I learned a ton already. I learned about imputation and a lot of other cool things. So we will be back at some point in the near future. There's some travel coming up for me, so I'm not going to be doing this for another few weeks. We'll see what I can squeeze in when I can. But again, thanks everybody for listening in, and I wish you all the very, very best. Have a happy Thursday, and we'll see you soon. Bye-bye.